And good morning. Welcome to another edition of Health Essentials. I am completely unprepared this morning. I found myself sidetracked reading about the Chinese herb, astragalus, and its ability to help the heart. And the more that I read about it, I realized, I said, hey, Roy, you got to focus on something else, son. The number here at the station is 903-586-5257. I do not watch the news. I don't think that I'm an ostrich that buries his head in the sand and just hopes for the best. But I would just rather seek out information on my own. Yes, I go to YouTube and I listen to videos, probably from the news. And some of it, you know, I just kind of think through it myself and think, is that even relevant or not? The complete idea, and forgive me, if I can, let's just spend just a brief moment talking about the coronavirus. The idea that they're going to find a vaccine specifically for it anytime soon is just, it's a fairy tale. I just do not see that happening. I hope that I'm wrong about that. But I seriously doubt it's going to take place. So what I want to encourage you to do is, I need you or want you to become your own best advocate. The better that you choose to take care of yourself, the more steps that you take to help improve the function of your immune system, I think things are going to bode a lot better for you. So if you did actually have a severe viral infection like the coronavirus or the COVID-19, maybe your body can turn the tide more quickly. Maybe it can respond with greater virulence and it can actually overcome this. Now, I did not prepare as much as I wanted to. However, let me just reiterate a couple of points right here. All these things are very, very complex. I've had so many people tell me that they believe that the coronavirus was designed by a man or a chemist or a virologist in a lab somewhere. I just absolutely have the hardest time buying into that or even considering that, because viruses, by their very nature, even though they're teeny tiny, super, super small, they are so complex. It's like a whole different universe exists inside of them. On one level, they have such sophistication and complexity. I just cannot wrap my mind around the idea that this could be created completely by a scientist. I just don't see that happening. Anyway, to make a very long story short, viruses are going to be part of our life. There's so many of them, I couldn't even begin to list even just a few of them. But it's part of the world that we live in. But what I want you to think of is, what can I do to help my immune system function at its very, very best? Well, that's your best play right now. You do have to use the wits that God's given you, which means maybe you need to avoid contact where there's large groups of people. And I think that's been settled for us. Even in Tyler, there's a lockdown right now. On some level. Well, let me try to give you some information right here. I have a book in front of me. It's called Herbal Antivirals by Stephen Buhner. It's a good book. Of course, to me, this is right up my alley. This is the sort of thing that I like to read about. Anyway, let me try to make this sound very, very simple. This particular type of virus that we're dealing with in the media right now and in the world is called an RNA virus. That's what the coronavirus is. It's a strand of RNA. DNA viruses are going to be viruses like smallpox and polio. If you have a DNA type virus, it's almost, and I don't know if you've heard this before, and I have probably mentioned it, but I'll mention it again. Viruses, under certain circumstances, they can reproduce every 60 seconds. I think I've read that even some of them can completely replicate themselves or reproduce in under 60 seconds. That is crazy. But that's reality. A DNA virus is almost like a perfect, exact replica or copy of the original virus. And so it doesn't change. Meaning if smallpox or polio reproduces, it makes a perfect mirror image of itself. And so when a vaccine is made, there's not much chance, there's just no mutation. And so if they produce a vaccine against a DNA virus, chances are it's going to be highly, highly effective. Now, influenza, you know what causes the flu, that is an RNA virus. And that is just a single strand of genetic material instead of that double helix called DNA. And so an RNA virus, it does not make a perfect mirror image of itself. Oh, it's close, all right. It may even look almost identical. Let me give you an example. I don't know that I know exactly what the type of Spanish flu was. Did it come from a bird? Did it come from a swine? Was it the H5N1 mutation of the flu back in 1918, where maybe as many as 100 million people worldwide passed away because of the complications thereof? I don't know. I just know that they identified back in 1913. They're almost positive that the bird flu was able to mutate, which means it could start entering a human being. So what you have with an RNA virus is, if it's specific for chickens or for birds, for example, it's going to start to share and blend some of the genetic information from the sparrow or the starling, the turkey, the pigeon, the grackle, crow. What birds am I missing? Ducks. Did I mention chickens yet? But anyway, it'll start sharing and mingling the genetic information from the host animal with the virus itself. So it continually changes slightly. So the idea that they're going to have a vaccine that's going to be very effective, I find that hard to believe anytime soon. Maybe they will figure it out. I'm rooting for them. I hope they do. But an RNA-type virus, it continually changes. And so this type of a virus, there's a whole bunch of viruses, from herpes to, certain forms of hepatitis, rhabdoviruses, togoviruses, flaviviruses, paramyoviruses. It just keeps going and going. But coronavirus is one of those. They have this viral envelope that surrounds them. It covers their protein capsid, which is like their outer shell. Almost you think of like a cell wall. And so this viral envelope that surrounds the coronavirus is composed of what are called glycoproteins. And these are things that have this very unique ability to attach to certain types of cells. So what I want you to think of is, I want you to think of a virus being like the seed of a plant. If it falls to the ground on soil that is not receptive for growth, I don't know, maybe I could say dry, hot sand in the Sahara Desert. I mean, you and I could toss all the watermelon and cantaloupe seeds in the universe onto the Sahara Desert, but that's probably not the right soil for watermelons to start sprouting forth. I wonder what kind of vine was produced when Jonah needed his shade from the hot sun as he looked over Nineveh. I don't know. But it's a plant that God prepared, right? So you can take all the watermelon seeds you want. If you toss them to sand that's 111 degrees Fahrenheit on a cool day, and there's no water, well, I just seriously doubt that watermelon seed's going to take. But if you take the watermelon seed and you toss it on very highly fertile, moist ground that's been freshly tilled, and then you cover it a little bit, oh my word, it's probably going to sprout. So you got to think of your cells in your body like soil. Have you ever heard the quote from Socrates? people are like dirt. Some of them will help you to be nourished and to grow and to flourish. Others will choke you to death. Anyway, I digress. So you got to think in terms of, is your soil or your tissue a good place for viruses to grow? And that's what these viruses do. They've got to find the proper receptors on your cells to be able to bind with them. And what they do is, as soon as this coronavirus fuses with the cell, it creates a pore or a hole in the cell, almost like taking an impact driver or a drill, drilling a hole through the cell wall of your cell, and voila, all of a sudden you have the virus entering the cell. And so these viruses, the coronavirus, takes over the cell they've entered, they reproduce, and then it bursts open, and then it spreads to other cells. Now this is the part that I wanted to share with you this morning. I would so much rather focus on solutions than focus on fear-mongering or trying to get people scared or worked up. You know, maybe I should be more scared than I am, but I'm really not. I would say there is a huge arsenal in your body. Always remember that God created the greatest pharmacy of all time. I think that let's cover this topic right here. There is a common herb known as licorice. I think when I was a boy, there used to be more so common to find licorice chewing gum, which I think tastes good. And actually, I like the taste of licorice tea. If you go to the store and you purchase throat coat tea, what does it have? Marshmallow root, slippery elm, and licorice? Well, licorice has this very unusual sweet flavor to it. Some people really dig it and some people don't. I guess if you grew up during the Great Depression and candy and delicacies were rather scarce because everybody was dirt poor, well, maybe licorice root is right up your alley. But licorice root is very, very interesting. I started thinking to myself this morning, if somebody comes to see me and I examine them, and I'm convinced through the physical examination, and it could be a combination of things, and I'll just kind of lay this out for you. Let's just say a person's tonsils stay continually swollen. And when I feel of the posterior cervical lymph node chain and the anterior chain, and there's plenty of lymph nodes. And then when I press over the spleen is very tender. Always remember, the spleen is the largest filter of the immune system. It is not uncommon for your spleen to enlarge or to become tender and painful when you're dealing with some type of a viral infection. And there are people that have chronic viral infections. They never seem to get over them, and they're very discouraged. One of those might be called Epstein-Barr. Anyway, back to licorice root. What do you do when somebody has tried every drug and treatment for a chronic viral infection they can't quite get well? Well, enter licorice root. Now, I was trying to look up the research on this, and I have some of it right here. It says in this textbook that licorice and its constituents, they act by inhibiting the ability of these enveloped viruses, and that's like what the coronavirus is. It prevents them to fuse with the host cells, meaning your cells. It says it does this. One of the actions they've discovered, that if you took a little bit of licorice, but I've used licorice root forever. Well, not forever, but as long as I've been doing this. And licorice root is very, very interesting. I've had many people that they could not turn their health around until I introduced licorice root. And so if someone is examined and there's a strongest probability, and even you can go get a lab work, it is very common when somebody has a higher monocyte count on their blood test and they have a very low white blood cell count, well, sometimes that's part and parcel to a chronic viral load. Or What if the segmented neutrophils are high and the lymphocytes are low? Well, that might be what you'd see with a bacterial infection. So if you go to the doctor and they say your labs are normal, but you see several markers on your white blood cell count would be high or low, that ain't normal. So if your lymphocytes are elevated and your monocytes are elevated and your white blood cell count's low, you might have some type of viral infection. What if it's a chronic viral infection, not necessarily by coronavirus? But they've shown that licorice root, it significantly reduces the membrane fluidity of both the host cell and the virus. Now, get this right here. I don't know if this will make sense to you, but they were referring to a study on HIV or AIDS infections. As little as a 5% reduction in the host cell membrane fluidity will reduce HIV infection by 56%. That's huge. It says an increase when your cell membrane becomes more fluid, that will enhance the ability of a virus to infect your body by 2.4-fold, thus more than doubling it. So licorice root has a very unique action to protect a person against a virus. It reduces the fluidity of your cell membrane. Now, this is what I find very, very interesting. And just kind of hear me out on this. I don't know what your definition of high cholesterol is. I don't know that I want to follow the main medical model. But I'll tell you this. They've shown that when there's excess cholesterol in the bloodstream, and all I'm going to say is that would be either a smidgen higher or moderately higher than what your medical doctor would want, maybe above 200 on total cholesterol. But when you have more cholesterol, that reduces your host cell fluidity, which that's what licorice root does. And so did you know that licorice root, it looks almost identical to cholesterol? I find that so fascinating. So the researchers that studied this, they postulated that this could act in a number of ways, whether it's your cholesterol is a little bit higher than it should be, or you're taking licorice root. This prevents viruses from going through the cell membrane, getting into your cells, and reproducing. So what I want to ask you is, do you think it's possible that cholesterol-lowering drugs could actually make you more susceptible to a viral infection? Well, that's what I want to know. I had a very, very nice gentleman bring me this article, and it was so fascinating. It was talking about how drugs can change the landscape of your nervous system or your brain. And in this one study, it was looking at what's called Tylenol or acetaminophen, in which this drug is a painkiller and a fever reducer. Oh my goodness. It is ordered by the thousands and thousands of tons each year from overseas. I'll let you guess which country it's manufactured in. Haha, you know it. But this particular drug, it works on the same center of the brain that regulates pain, as well as empathy. So you've got two sides of the coin here. You've got pain and suffering, or you've got compassion and empathy. And in the study, they asked the question, does a person's empathy, is it greatly reduced when they take Tylenol? Yes. If you take Tylenol every day, the studies are showing that you have less chance that you're going to be empathetic. Well, isn't that interesting? Well, then I looked at his article on cholesterol. And it showed that in one particular study, which I found this so fascinating, that when people had high cholesterol, very little chance of them participating in a very violent crime. And so they're showing literally that when someone is on a cholesterol-lowering drug, or the lower their cholesterol, that's what I should have said, I'm sorry. I retract that last one. Let me just say it the way I read it. When someone has lower cholesterol, they are more prone to violent crimes. And so do cholesterol-lowering drugs in the body, do they reduce in some circumstances the ability of your body to reduce infections. Well, I think it's very interesting. Anyway, last week I think I shared with you that when you eat an egg from a chicken, there's two parts of the egg. Well, I'm skipping the shell, but once you crack the shell open and you pour the egg into a skillet with butter in it, which is my favorite way, you have the egg white and you have the yolk. Well, in the egg yolk, that's where the nutrition is. And so let's just say the chickens you're getting the eggs from, they get to run around the yard and they get to, you know, eat ants or fleas. I know it sounds gross, but if they eat a tick or an earthworm or a June bug or just anything, or a caterpillar, that's what they do. And if they scratch around and they eat seeds from different vegetation, all the better. Well, chickens, got to give them some good rocks. Let them crush it in their gullet and their gizzard. But when you eat an egg from a chicken, they've estimated that each egg yolk from an egg is going to contain somewhere between 100 to maybe 150 milligrams of what are called immunoglobulins. Now, you do not have to be the top hematologist at UT Tyler or UT South. No, you don't have to. Immunoglobulins, these are things that protect you against viral infections or bacterial infections. So you tell me, are eggs bad just because they have high cholesterol? No, they're not bad at all. If you'd like to join me on the radio, there's a phone line open at 903-586-5257. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Dr. Morgan. Last week, I had a sore throat come upon me, and I took vitamin C, honey, and salt water and gargled with it, and it felt better. But afterward, I had these, I noticed I had these huge bumps on the back of my tongue, and it felt like I had something in my throat and I couldn't swallow. And you were talking about how membranes have liquid in it. Is there some way I can maybe reduce those?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have a fever or anything. And if you look at, like if you put three pebbles close together,
mm-hmm.
and then you put one on top of it, that's kind of like what those bumps look like on the back of my tongue.
Are they just staying the same, or are they changing?
They're staying about the same.
Okay, let me give you two or three ideas right here. Here's the first thought that popped in my mind, and I don't know if this is right or not, but when you were born as a little baby girl, you were born with five sets of tonsils. You've got your adenoids up at the top and the back of the throat, and at the lower back of the throat, you've got the large palatine tonsils. Those suckers are huge. You have the lingual tonsil. Now, that's the tonsil that's right there at the root or the base of your tongue. And then you've got the laryngeal tonsil. You have heard somebody before that's lost their voice with laryngitis, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have a set of tonsils around the eustachian tubes that connect to the ears. So each one of them serves a very unique, particular purpose in trying to make sure that your body stays free from infection. It's just part of the natural immune system, which it plays a very, very significant role in keeping people well. So when you look at the long-term studies on people that have their tonsils removed when they're very young, yes, and I'm not trying to be negative, they have a much more significant lifetime risk for cancer than somebody that hasn't had their tonsils removed. And so anything that happens at the root or the base of the tongue, I start thinking about the lingual tonsil. I can't just see it with the naked eye like I can the adenoids or the palatine tonsils, but it's there nonetheless. So one or two things that you can try, and this is really strong, so you got to tell me if you're okay with it. There's a type of a substance that they would push into a ham to make it decorated, or into an apple. It's called cloves.
Okay.
And cloves are a spice, but if they distill cloves, you can extract what's called clove oil. Some people refer to it as essential oil. But clove is really, really strong. And so Is there any possibility that some of your teeth are a little bit achy or sore at the same time?
No. Matter of fact, the only problem, you know, that I have now is that when I try to swallow, those bumps, you know, just make me feel like I've got something caught back there. And occasionally they get a little tender.
Well, do they look red when you look at them?
They did at first. Now they don't, but they're still okay. The same size.
Okay, so here's what we want to do. If you could just take, let's just say a cup, and we're going to make it half apple cider vinegar and half water. I want you to add maybe one drop. When I said maybe, I started to say two, but I changed my mind. We're going with one. One drop of clove oil. And what I want you to do is I want you to gargle with this and make sure that you spit it out.
Okay.
But if you'll gargle with this for 30 seconds three times a day, let's see if we can get those bumps to heal and reduce. The other thing that can be done that's just like so easy, even at the large stores, if you're able to go to a store to shop for groceries, which I think you can legally, you can get a tea called Throat Coat Tea.
I do have some of that. Never thought about using it.
Oh, yeah. Let's just start working that all day long. Now, I know what I would do if it were me. I would probably add maybe just a teaspoon of raw honey to that.
Okay.
And then on top of that, I would probably add also, if you have access to fresh lemon juice, when I say lemon juice, I'm just talking about cutting a lemon in half and putting out one of those juicing reamers or that wooden dowel or a lemon press. Get the juice of it and sip on that throughout the day. The other thing, if you can find them, they have what are called slippery elm lozenges. And they don't cost much more than $1.25 at the health food store. You could suck on those, but that will help heal and resolve those fluid-filled bumps on the back of your tongue.
Okay. Well,
so
that
you can
sounds good.
Yeah, and hopefully you'll be able to swallow pretty quick here. But you have not awakened in the middle of the night with a huge puddle of sweat surrounding your body as you're breaking a fever.
No, I haven't had any fever at all.
If you get licorice tea, that would be a good call also, and that stuff tastes good.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever have licorice candy when you were a little girl?
Yes, and I have licorice capsules now, and I've been taking those, but I haven't been breaking them open and gargling with it or anything.
Well, if you can tolerate it, you can pour them directly into your hot cup of tea and just let them simmer, and you can sip on that, and they'll be fine.
Okay.
Of course, there could be, like, chunks of debris in there, but how does that affect me at all? I'm not the one doing it. No, you'll be fine if you do that. Now, if you need to also, you could actually take a very warm washcloth and just lay it over your throat and see if that helps it to drain. But as you continue to gargle with salt water, do you think that's probably not helping much anymore?
I quit after I stopped having pain.
Okay, I'm with you. Well, just try what I told you and see if that doesn't bring about some healing and some relief.
Okay.
And if the sun comes out today, go outside and sit in the fresh air and light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Okay, well, thank you so much.
Yes, ma'am.
I appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right, if you'd like to join me on the air, 903-586-5257. All right. Came across an article about a Chinese herb called astragalus. It's very easy for me to say this is for the immune system, but I got sidetracked just reading about all the good actions concerning the heart. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Morgan. How are you?
I'm excellent. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, hunkered down here at the farm.
Well, that's the safest place to be, isn't it?
I think so at the moment, I do.
Is there a chance that you could go all day without seeing another human being?
Uh-huh.
Okay, just checking.
Yes. Hey, I have a question. I've been diagnosed as osteoporosis. And I know you've talked about this, but, you know, I didn't write down any notes because it didn't pertain to me. So now that I'm osteoporosis and not pina anymore, I figured I best call.
Where is it located?
You know what? They haven't told me yet. They only took x-ray of my hips.
Well, then that's where it is.
Oh, okay. Last time they did, like years ago, they did the whole spine.
Most likely they took a picture of the neck of your femur.
Okay.
That's where your leg thigh bone joins the pelvis.
So, and if you're have a funky left one that, you know, gets tender if I sleep on it.
Well, I mean, but still, if your hip is tender on that ball and socket joint, that is actually a very common physical manifestation of osteoporosis.
Wow.
Which means, if we turn all this around in reverse, if the pain goes away, that would give me confidence that you're building bones at a faster rate than what they're breaking down. So,
yeah.
All right, let me have a go at it, okay?
Yep.
All right, number
one. Let me
one.
Hang up or...
Oh, no, whatever you want to do. If you want to hang on.
No, I'll listen.
Let me just cover the very, very basic stuff.
Okay, and so I'm on D, and I take about 10,000 a day, and then off on the weekends.
Maybe even a little bit more important than vitamin D would be vitamin K2.
K2. So
sometimes it's called minoquinone 4 or minoquinone 7.
Okay, so the product contains D and K, but because you can't take so much K, because it's not fat soluble, I take an extra D, plain D.
No, vitamin K is fat soluble.
Oh, okay. I was told to only take... Okay.
Well, anyway, let's just say, what is the role of vitamin K2? It plays a very specific role in helping to encourage calcium. So when you eat broccoli or you eat kale or you have cottage cheese or Swiss cheese or, you know, salmon with butter and lemon juice on it, all those contains very significant amounts of calcium that come from either, you know, plants that have processed it from the soil or from an animal. So when you take in the calcium, it is one of the roles of vitamin D3 to make sure that calcium goes from the inner parts of your gut into the bloodstream. But once it gets in the bloodstream, it's not really the role or the job of vitamin D3 to get it to the bones. That's the job of vitamin K2. So if you have osteoporosis, and you do, you may want to tweak this and make it easier for your body to work a little bit better. So you may want to take additional amounts of vitamin K2. Usually I'm going for over 1,000 micrograms to help make sure that you can transport calcium from the bloodstream to the bones where it belongs.
Okay.
All right, point number two. There's been so much research on this. I still think there's so much confusion, so I'm going to try to break it down very, very simple. The form of calcium that is found in your bones, I know I'm an oversimplifier, but it's called MCHC. That stands for microcrystalline hydroxyapatite. MCHC. And so that's the only form that has ever really, really been shown to significantly enhance the bones. And so, yes, calcium takes this crystalline form. And so that's why I'm, out of all the things that I've ever used, I usually just use raw MCHC if I'm trying to help a person rebuild their bones.
Okay.
So, if you want to get raw bone calcium, that's the way to do it right there. Okay, number next. If I had to choose between the two, if you said, can I take Citracal or Oscal or what can I take to help my bones, I would choose magnesium. Magnesium plays a more powerful role in making sure that your bones stay hard and strong than what calcium does. I know that's completely counter to what everybody else says, but if I had my way, I would focus on vitamin K2. I'd use the raw bone calcium called MCHC, and I'd focus on magnesium. Does that make sense?
Yeah. How much magnesium?
Well, you have to find the Goldilocks just right amount. So if you were to use something like magnesium glycinate or magnesium gluconate or citrate malate, or I like magnesium lactate, if you take that, you're not trying to take so much that it gives where you have an osmolytic effect upon your bowels and have to run to the bathroom. So you're not trying to take that much, but probably somewhere between 300 to maybe 600 milligrams a day is going to be a very good starting place. Every human being is different, so you can experiment and try and see what's going to give you the biggest bang for the buck.
Okay.
Now, can I just give you one more point?
Of course.
All right. Now, this is going to be different, but when you take two crystals and you rub them together, they generate what's called a piezoelectric charge. So every time that you're walking barefoot across the farm and your heel or foot strikes the ground when you take a step forward, or you're jogging or running, that creates a piezoelectric charge. That is what tells the bones to grow new bone tissue. So without physical activity, it is impossible to lay down new bone. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Do you like to exercise?
No.
How dare you go against my brilliant plan for you? Well, but do you feel like as part of just running the farm and taking care of the animals, you get a lot of physical activity?
I think I do, but, you know, maybe not. I think I do. I mean...
Well, just off the top of your head, without overthinking it, why would you have osteoporosis?
My grandmother had it very badly, and she had Dower's hump. I'm small like she is, and so that's what I'm thinking. I mean, I have very low D. I struggle to keep my D up.
This is just an idea. A lot of times if I find a woman or a man has very low levels of vitamin D, even though they're taking it, I always think there's something that's interfering with absorption. So I know I'm going to say this very simply. It's not going to sound like it's super logical or scientific, but I think in some people, when they eat modern genetically modified wheat, it just wrecks their absorption of vitamin D. Now, I'm not trying to say that I have that completely, totally, 100% figured out. But I know it happens. That's an observation that I've made over and over again. So if somebody comes in my door and they have low vitamin D, I think, okay, what is not right with this picture? They're getting sunshine, they're taking vitamin D, but it stays low. If you're eating a food that generates some degree of inflammation on the lining of the gut, yeah, that right there could destroy the ability of your body to absorb and assimilate vitamin D. So if it's not wheat, then sugar is the next food that I look at. I think it's impossible to probably suggest that you're going to go the rest of your life without eating some sugar. That's probably not going to happen. But if you could reduce the amount of sugar, that's going to be a godsend. You know what I said earlier about magnesium probably playing a more powerful role at strengthening the bones than even calcium does?
Yeah.
If you were to drink a Pepsi Cola, if you look at the label, it says it contains phosphoric acid. I'm not trying to like go into too many chemical reactions here on the radio that sounds too wordy, but that stuff is so acidic, mm-hmm. It'll burn a hole right through your bones. But even one can of Pepsi is going to leach probably 40 milligrams of magnesium from your bones. That is not good.
Wow. Well, I gave up for Lent. I gave up sugar, except for a little bit of creamer in my coffee, so I'm a happy person in the morning. And then I did give up bread and wheat and all that stuff. And I've lost almost 9 pounds.
Whoa, that's huge.
Yeah, it could be also it's lambing season. So.
Two more things real quick.
Yeah.
I know this is just a great oversimplification, but there's a type of fat called cod liver oil.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Cod liver oil is a superfood. I'm not interested in somebody else's opinion because I've seen it work over and over again, but it contains some vitamin D from an animal source and vitamin A. Cod liver oil enhances how you rebuild the bones. So if you just consider those things right there.
Do they make cod liver oil in like capsules or a way to take it where it's
It's not the liquid?
No, ma'am, they do not. The only way that you're going to get it is if you take your kayak and go to the Arctic Circle and you do your duty and you start fishing for, like, some delicious fish in the frozen ocean.
Or more salmon.
Yeah, I'm really just joking about that. Of course, they make it in a gel cap where you don't have to taste it.
Okay. How are sardines? Because I love sardines.
Oh, I love sardines, too. That's going to be good.
Okay, okay. All right, then I think it's the magnesium, that MCHC.
Yeah, it's just raw bone calcium.
And I'm going to work more on walking barefoot on the farm.
If you do that, you will see a change in your body that you'll be very pleased with.
When I'm in town, I walk barefoot a lot, but I don't when I'm out here. But I'll pick a spot and find it.
Good. Good girl.
And for about 15, 20 minutes?
That sounds like a winner.
Really? Okay. All right. Sounds good.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
I was reading in a book by the author John Rady. He said that archaeologists along this river that's in Illinois, and to me this is very, very interesting. Along this river, they found two distinctive areas where Indians, you know, they buried those that had passed from the tribe. And they broke it down into two different distinct groups. There was one group of the Indians along this river, and I cannot remember if it was the Ohio, the Mississippi, or the Illinois River. So forgive me, I can go back and look it up. Sorry. But there was one group of Indians that they were strictly hunter-gatherers. So when I say a hunter-gatherer, you know what I mean. They're constantly moving to where the animals are. You know what animals do? They do what animals do. They forage, they constantly search and seek out food. They graze, and so they go to all these different parts of the, you know, the earth looking for food to eat. And so they tend to have a much wider variety of nutrients. The hunter-gatherers also are very, very famous for being experts at fishing. They collect berries when they're in season and nuts when they're in season, so if they happen to come along a field of dandelion greens, guess what they're having for supper? They're having salad. But if they find, say, mulberries on a mulberry tree, that's what they're going to have also. And what Dr. Rady did was archaeologists compared against another group of Indians that tended to be more agrarian or farmers, and their primary crops were going to be corn and beans. And all they did was they would excavate or exhume the skeletons, and they were trying to determine what is the evidence of how healthy these people were. Well, I know you know the answer to this, but those that were farmers that relied on corn and beans, they were much shorter, they had more body fat, they had so many more infections in their teeth and their bones than those that were the hunter-gatherers. And, of course, one thing that I would gather from that they made the comment on, when you're living in a farming community, you tend to be more huddled together where there's more people per square mile or more people per, you know, people just all crammed together. Of course, in my mind, I think, oh, my goodness, what about the people that live in these apartment complexes where they're just all crammed together? That's just asking for it, isn't it, when it comes to an infection? As opposed to the hunter-gatherers, who were taller, more athletic, they lived a lot longer, according to this archaeological study, and they had the fewest infections, and they had the least amount of disease. To me, that's very interesting. And of course, I don't want to overthink this, but if you plant corn in the ground, that is the only chance that the corn's going to have. It can only draw nutrients from the earth that is planted in. Does that make sense? Whereas an animal, can I just say a caribou? I don't know why I'm saying, I don't know if they had caribou in Illinois, but that's what popped in my head. I'm probably wrong about that. But caribou, they graze and forage over hundreds and hundreds of miles of tundra. I know I just went from Illinois up to the Arctic Circle again, or to Alaska. I'm sorry, I butchered that one. But you understand. So what if a caribou was on some soil and eating, you know, a plant that the soil was a very poor quality? Well, most likely the nutrition of the caribou is going to be very poor. So as it grazes and moves to better pasture lands, what's going to happen if it gets a greater variety of minerals and nutrients? And so what you find is when animals are allowed to forage, or salmon, you know, swim thousands of miles, they pick up nutrients from all parts of the ocean and all parts of the earth. And so by the time that they're eaten by human beings, they have a much greater, you know, density of nutrition as compared to like a chicken that's raised in a house. You tell me, what's the nutrient density of a chicken that's able to go out and eat earthworms and June bugs and all manner of wild seeds and plants? It's going to be so much greater than if it's just given chicken feed from genetically modified corn and whatnot. Well, you know that. Anyway, so just think, your body needs variety. The stronger you need to be, you need to have a variety. You cannot function just on peanut butter and jelly only. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Dr. Morgan, good to hear from you this morning.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
Question. I have a friend that lost her right arm in an automobile accident.
Oh, dear. I'm so sorry about that.
Thank you. She's having such severe phantom pains. It's tremendous. And do you have a suggestion of what she can do to ease those phantom pains?
Well, this is going to sound crazy and nutty, but let me have a go at it, okay?
Okay.
Okay, at the I don't know, where was the arm severed? Was it above the elbow or below or just above the wrist or where?
About 10 inches below the shoulder.
Okay. So it goes almost to the elbow, but not quite, right?
Yes, uh-huh.
Okay, so...
No, I'd say less than halfway.
Okay, well, even if we get it wrong, I don't think it matters, but you know where I'm going with this.
Okay.
With this phantom pain, there is a... well, let me just go ahead and say it. It's usually a mixture of different soils. It'll have volcanic ash, it'll have kaolin clay, it'll have calcium bentonite clay. It'll have all these different types of forms of bentonite, but if you were to go to the store, usually the product is called Indian Healing Clay.
Okay.
And a big tub of it, it's going to be in the dried powder, is going to cost maybe $10.
Okay.
It's probably more like $9, but I'm just trying to remember if I can see if I can recall the price of it. And so when you get this powder, what she's going to do is she may take out like a, let's just say a spoonful of the powder and put it in a glass bowl or a porcelain ceramic bowl. Something that's non-metal or non-plastic is what I'm getting to.
Okay.
She would add just enough water to it, and this could be spring water, where she's going to make, when she stirs it, I don't want it to be soupy and runny. I want it to be like a thick clay. You almost think about just a little bit looser than what a potter would put on a wheel if he was going to form like a bowl or a plate or a cup or something like that on the potter's wheel. So you're just trying to make, kind of a thick mud. But what I want her to do is I want her every day to smear that mud all over the severed arm.
Okay.
Especially down at the very end, the distal end of it where it's been severed. She can apply that mud there. Now, it's a weird feeling. Because when that mud starts to dry and crack, it just has a weird sensation. So if she could do that, I would probably try that for 2 weeks. Now, this is only my opinion, so take it with a grain of salt.
Okay.
If the sun is out, if she could just sunbathe that mud from the Indian Healing Clay on her arm and let it air dry for about 10, 15 minutes tops, then just wash it off. See if that totally stops the phantom pain.
Ooh, super. Okay.
The other thing that we can try is, and this one's going to be even, well, it's about the same category. Sometimes I'll try just using plain Jane castor oil for phantom pain. And what she would do is, every night before she goes to bed, she can just rub castor oil all over the area. And we're going to see if this helps lead to a healing. The other thing that I've tried before that I've seen work now, I hope I don't come across sounding like a know-it-all, because I do not know it all. I'm just telling you, I've had different cases, and so I'm telling you the things that have worked for them. So if clay did not work for one person, I might go to castor oil. If castor oil doesn't work, that's where I might take and just apply raw honey. And so there's many forms of raw honey. My two favorites are going to be the dark wildflower honey. That's where the bee has to earn its living by going from flower to flower to flower.
Okay.
Do you ever find it interesting when the wind is really blowing how a bee can just navigate through the wind like there's nothing to slow it down? I just don't get that. And what blows my mind even more is if you see a butterfly, like I watched a yellow butterfly the other day. It was super gusty, but that, do you think the butterfly was blown away? No, it just knew how to navigate through the stream like it was no big deal. Just blew my mind. So you can try applying raw honey. Now, with the castor oil and the honey, you've got to give the body a chance to kind of drink it up or soak it up. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
So if she could leave the honey on there for a minimum of 45 minutes, for all I know, her body will just completely drink it up. The fourth thing that I might look at is a homeopathic remedy known as Arnicare. And that comes in kind of a clear gel. It may seem a little greasy, but if she can rub it on there, the body will start to drink it up. She could actually apply that 6, 8, 9, 10 times a day. But let's see if any of those four things completely will kill and do away with the phantom pain, so she can, you know, live without having those annoying symptoms.
I didn't understand that last remedy. Arnipain, is that what?
It's called Arnicare.
Arnicare, okay.
I think it's Arnicare. Arnicare.
Arnicare, okay, I got it.
And I've seen that at Family Dollar and, dollar stores.
Right.
It doesn't cost a dollar either. It's more like $6 or $7.
Well, if we can get her some relief, it would be godsend, because she had really suffered with this.
One more thing.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I'm just really bad about this. I'm not trying to add so many things to the list that we get lost in the mix here, but I'm just trying to tell you that each one of these, in its own fair right, it could potentially work wonders for her. So there is a cayenne pepper-based salve that they sell at the store. It's called Capsaicin P. But it's very irritating because it's got cayenne peppers in it.
Right.
But that takes about 2 to 3 weeks of application. If she rubs it exactly where she has the pain, I want to see if this completely turns that phantom pain off where she no longer feels it. But even that potentially could work like a champ.
Ooh, that sounds super.
Oh, yeah. I think I've given some good advice now. What I think you should do is you should rub it on her arm for her, and then I want you to scratch your nose. I'm joking. That would set your nose on fire. You don't even know how many times I've done that to myself where I've touched a person's knee, and I said, well, weren't you going to tell me that was like full of cayenne pepper first? Set me on fire.
I think I'll skip that part.
I know. I was just joking. So if she were to try those things, oh, my. Let's see if we can turn this off and she could have a new lease on life.
Super, super. I can't wait to try these out.
Yeah, you betcha. Thanks for your call.
Thank you, Doug.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
What a sweet man. He loves her so much, he's going to call on her behalf and see if he can't find a solution to her pain and suffering. Okay, if you want to join me on the radio, there's a phone line open. We have just a few more minutes left. It's 903-586-5257. I think I had to push that button 5 times to get to work. Anyway, good morning. Welcome to the program.
I guess the 5th time is charm?
The 5th time is a charm. That's right.
Hey, I've never heard you talk about this, and I don't know if there's anything for it. But what about ringing in the ear?
Ringing in the ear?
Yes, sir.
Is it one ear or both?
It started as one ear, and now it's both.
Okay. Is there any use of ibuprofen or Tylenol or aspirin?
No.
Well, for other people that are listening, those are very, very famous for causing ototoxicity or tinnitus or tinnitus. So if that's not it, there are studies that demonstrate that if a human being is even a little bit low in magnesium, the net result is hearing and ear problems.
Okay.
Specifically ringing in the ear. So a lot of times if a human being is low in magnesium, they're more prone to being a bit goosey or ticklish. Does that describe you?
Yes.
Oh, well, I'm not going to tickle you. You don't have anything to worry about.
But childhood, yes.
And a lot of times also, when someone's low in magnesium, they tend to really crave and go after chocolate, since chocolate has magnesium.
I do like chocolate.
And you know what I said earlier? I'm not trying to pick on the manufacturers of Pepsi, but Pepsi contains phosphoric acid. And phosphoric acid is usually found in commercially or grocery store available soft drinks. You know what I'm talking about, like Cokes and Dr. Peppers, Mountain Dew, stuff like that. That there's not many things that will literally suck the magnesium out of a human being like that does.
Yeah. Well, I drink lemon water, so I don't think that's going to do
it. Oh, listen, you're doing awesome. Keep up the good work. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just wondering to put magnesium back in my body, what's a good dosage to start with?
Well,
how would I know if I need to go up?
Now, let me say this first before I answer that question.
Sure.
You know absolutely what it's like to be very calm and happy and to be in a good place spiritually and emotionally, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, you wake up and you go, oh, Lord, thank you for this beautiful day. What can I do to serve you? This is so wonderful. Thank you so much for your blessing.
Got it.
When a person is going through what I would call very significant stress, I think I tend to tell myself they're probably burning through or running through their magnesium that they hold in reserve at a much faster rate than what they would otherwise. And so I just naturally assume that when a human being is under some stress, they're probably depleting their magnesium at a faster rate than what they're replacing it. So to go back and answer your question, anytime that you can, the lemon water is a good call. That's brilliant on your part.
Your part.
Oh, you mean you're following my directions?
Yes, sir.
Oh, I may come up with something unusual in just a little bit to tell you to do every day. No, I'm joking. But when you consume, there's a type of salt that you can buy at the store known as Celtic or Celtic salt.
Mm-hmm.
I like that because it's about 68% pure magnesium. I love the idea of if every person put two heaping cups of Epsom salt in a bathtub of warm water or hot water and they soaked once a week, I think we'd have a whole bunch of healthier people. Because
really?
You will literally, yes, you'll drink up the magnesium through your skin.
Okay.
They actually sell what's called magnesium oil.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday when I was brushing my teeth, I just sprayed on my toothbrush and brushed my teeth with it. Yes, it doesn't taste great, but it's under the headline or the category of I'm doing this because it's good for me, not because I'm worried about the taste. It's very, very salty.
So can I mix that with the baking soda I use?
You can.
Okay.
But you would use just a little bit, so... Actually, when you look at the United States
right.
Department of Agriculture magnesium studies, almost mm-hmm. all the soil in America is very deficient in magnesium. That's one of the reasons why if you went to the store and you bought a bag of Epsom salt, which is magnesium sulfate, and you sprinkled a little bit around your tomato plants or your peppers, well, they're going to grow better. So a lot of times when the leaves of a plant tend to be very pale or yellowing, that can be a magnesium deficiency. It can be an iron also.
So what is the spray that you talked about? Pardon me.
The spray is called magnesium oil.
Okay.
Yeah, unfortunately. Runners? Yeah, absolutely. And eat vegetables. Green vegetables are going to be a great source of that and nuts.
Hey, does cauliflower count as a green vegetable?
It does in my book,
like,
but not really.
I know it's not green, but I just told it's green.
No, I'd rather you eat cauliflower than have... grains. So that's good. Thanks for your phone call, buddy.
You're welcome. I appreciate you. Thank you.
You're so welcome. I appreciate you for listening to the station. Y'all have a good weekend. Bye-bye. Okay, I think I've gone just a hair over. Please forgive me. I'm Dr. Roy Morgan. This program is Health Essentials. I will see you this time, Lord willing, next week at 7 o'clock.